document. The American president describes it as a, quote, roadmap to ensure that America remains the greatest, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond its rhetoric, the NSS is a serious undertaking in dangerous times that can't be ignored. KJ Noe is an award-winning journalist, political analyst, writer, and teacher specializing in the geopolitics of the Asia-Pacific region. His prodigious contribution to political analyses of global issues can be found online at, among other places, Dissident Voice, The People's Daily, Global Times, and at Counterpunch, where his recent article, How to Read the New National Security Strategy Document, appears. KJ is, too, a frequent commentator on various news programs, co-hosts The China Report on the Breakthrough News Network, and contributed with Finian Cunningham et al. To Killing Democracy. Welcome to the program, KJ.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, KJ, you recommend in your article everyone read the entire NSS document to divinate its meaning, but admit that those trying must do so in the dark, or at least partial dark. KJ, how do we get to the truth of the matter when the administration is releasing only parts of its plan for the future?
Yeah, I think that's the key thing to understand. The National Security Strategy is a classified document. It's a secret document. It's not published openly any more than a corporation would make its strategic business plan public. What we are looking at is, if you will, the brochure or the business brochure for the empire, when actually the secret business plan for the empire, for global hegemony, really is hidden from us. And so we are a little bit like, you know, the blind men and the elephant. We're just, you know, feeling out different parts, and people are coming away with different impressions and interpretations. But the key thing to note here is that anybody who tells you that they have the, you know, fundamental interpretation of the NSS, unless they're part of the national security class, they don't know what they're talking about. Most of the pundits on the web are bringing their own subjective interpretation to it. And of course, that's understandable. But anybody who claims authority is not fully understanding the situation. The other point that I'll make is, you know, for me, it's really interesting to note how many people look at things that are happening and say, look, you know, things are not as they seem. There is a secret plan underneath this. And then they, you know, hypothesize all kinds of, you know, secret plans. But when they are actually presented with a document, which is simply a PR document, and which actually does have a secret plan underneath it, they take it at face value. And I find that very, very puzzling. So anyway, you know, make of that what you will. But as I said, this is the business plan for empire. It's the strategic business plan for hegemony. I think of the educator Paulo Freire, who said that it's important not just to read the word, as I encourage you to do, but to read the world, that we have to really read critically and, as they say, read against the grain, also turn up your BS detector to 13, because the narrator here is unreliable. That said, there's a way to read it that will help you get closer. The first thing to do is read for the contradictions in the text, because there are so many contradictions. This thing is packed with contradictions. So you cross-check it, you cross-verify against actions and policies and other things that are out there. I suggest that you assume deception. And if you do, you will probably be right, because nobody puts out their plan for global domination, you know, unless it is, Maxwell Smart's Dr. Yes, right? And you are not going to get that in print. But as you do that, you can start to see who some of the authors are. You can see influences on Rubio on the Western Hemisphere, Vance on Europe, Navarro on the economy, Colby on Taiwan, Miller on immigration, Secretary Hegseth everywhere. And then you start to understand that. And then this is the key distinction that I invite people to make. If you do any computer programming, you understand there's a difference between code and remarks. The code is what makes the machine do things. The remarks are things that you put in between the code that are supposed to explain what the code is about. But they first, they don't do anything. And secondly, you can write anything you want to. You can write a love letter to your girlfriend into the code. It won't make any difference because it doesn't actually do anything. If you look at the code, and really we have to look at the kernel of this, the code, or literally the firmware, you once you start to understand that and you compare it with other things that are going on as you start to read not just the word but the world, you can see that this is just a different shade of lipstick put onto the same imperial pig. It's the same beast, but with a makeup, with a makeover, with different makeup and a different outfit. So it hasn't changed. And you can see that there are four key elements that can be noted. One is this is an assertion of U.S. global hegemony. People say, you know, this is the restrainers or the prioritizers who've gotten the upper hand, not the primacists. But I disagree. You know, what looks like strategic retrenchment is probably strategic resequencing. And you can tell that immediately because, for example, they talk about retrenching to the Western Hemisphere, but they extend their defense perimeter all the way out to the South China Sea and the First Island Chain. They're very specific, concrete things that they talk about, ensuring the U.S. capacity to influence and to be military supreme in the First Island Chain. And for me, that's a very odd Western Hemisphere that reaches all the way out into the Pacific, into the South China Sea, into the First Island Chain. So I think that's the first thing that we can notice. And the second thing is that, of course, as I said, it is about strategic sequencing. So it's a reshifting or a resequencing of U.S. priorities, but it is not, I don't believe that it's a conversion document where, you know, all of a sudden the carnivore has become vegetarian, where the empire has suddenly decided it no longer is an empire, where, you know, McDonnell Douglas has decided it's going to be a nonprofit charity. Those things don't happen. Certainly they don't happen in this fashion. So we can see that there's simply strategic sequencing or resequencing. Russia, which was supposed to be an appetizer on the way to the main course, which was China, has now been reprioritized. It may come back up as a dessert course. But for now, the focus will be on China. And then related to the strategic sequencing or resequencing is the division of labor. So this is the burden shifting. It's the plan, really, to engage subcontractors for the plan. That is, the U.S. always uses contractors for its wars. But here it's contracting entire countries because it wants empire on the cheap. It wants empire with all the fixings on the cheap. And again, you can see that because there's very, very strong language in the NSS which mandates or urges, you know, U.S. allies to increase up their game, to increase their militarism, and to raise their military expenditures up to 5%. And so the way that I see it is, you know, this is, you know, this is what I get every Christmas as a Christmas gift. I get an announcement of a rent hike from my landlord, and the landlord tells me they're raising my rent because they own the building. And I think this is similar. You know, the U.S. is telling Europe and Korea and Japan, you know, we're raising your rents, and we're raising your rents because we own your rear end, we own your property. You know, you essentially have no digital sovereignty, you have no financial sovereignty, you don't have energy sovereignty, even your security architecture is dependent on you. And so when we raise the rent, you need to pay. Rents are going up and you need to pay your tithes to Rome, to the Vatican. And then there's another part which people seem to be focusing excessively on, in my opinion, and that's the section on, you know, the kind of culture wars and the identity politics and immigration, etc. It's an important part of the document, but I interpret, and this, you know, clearly is my own interpretation, is it's an attempt to justify the resequencing and, more importantly, disown the failure of the Ukraine war. That is to say, when capitalism runs into crisis, it tries to blame its failures on the other, in particular immigrants, in particular, other easy targets. And I think this is an attempt to disown that failure. So, Europe has too many immigrants. Never mind that those immigrants came from U.S. wars. This is why why Europe is overrun with immigrants from, North Africa, etc. And also, it's a way of conveniently blaming a surface issue such as identity politics and, wokeness, when actually the deep and core contradictions we have to understand as being systemic to late capitalism.
Well, now there's a lot there. How does this tie in, do you think? Yesterday, the landlord, or as Donald Trump is perfectly suited to call himself from his past life and present, issued his notice to Venezuela, saying that they were completely surrounded by the world's largest armada, and that the Americans weren't going to tolerate the theft of their oil and their land and their minerals and their everything that they want, that the Venezuelans are inconveniently parked atop, and that this wasn't going to go anymore. That I think it was an eviction notice to Venezuela. How does that tie in with the subtlety, as you described the meaning of this the document, the national security strategy, the front-facing document, is supposed to be more toned down, and now you've got Trump releasing yesterday in this tweet something in tone that is as naked an imperial declaration as can be imagined.
Yes, well, I wouldn't say that it's subtle all the way through. I think there's certain types of messaging. Certainly, I think it was toned down against Russia and China because they want to give the impression that there is some kind of strategic retreat or strategic stability for the time being. And they've explicitly said that in the NSS. But no, there's nothing subtle about empire. And the United States has always had, or at least, since Monroe, it has always had a Monroe Doctrine. So anybody who says that this Monroe Doctrine is new in the NSS hasn't been paying very much attention. The U.S. has always interfered in its backyard in Latin America. So yeah, this is, part of, the assumptions of hegemony, of exceptionalism, of an imperial mindset. And yes, how did our oil get under their territory, right? Just as, they always seem to be asking, how did China get its country so close to our bases, to threaten it? So there's always this kind of inverted thinking that is also, this large expression, overwhelming expression of exceptionalism and hegemony. And of course, yes, the landlord assumes that they own all the property, and they're sending an eviction notice, a threat, and the sheriffs are waiting just outside the door. And all of this is to threaten and to undermine. Certainly, it is designed to demoralize, hurt, and damage Venezuela and the Venezuelan people. But
And always delivered regretfully, with this sense of ruefulness that, well, we're really sorry that you've made us do this to you, but there's just nothing we can do.
Yes, we are actually the victims. You're forcing us to hurt you.
Well, If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with KJ No. KJ is an award-winning journalist, political analyst, writer, teacher, and he specializes in the geopolitics of the Asia-Pacific region. His prodigious contribution to political analyses of global issues can be found online at Dissident Voice, The People's Daily, Global Times, and Counterpunch, among other places. We're talking in and around his recent article at Counterpunch, How to Read the New National Security Strategy Document. KJ also co-hosts the China Report on the Breakthrough News Network, and he contributed to Finian Cunningham's book, Killing Democracy, Western Imperialism's Legacy of Regime Change and Media Manipulation. KJ, your two essays in that book, Targeting China, the Most Powerful Weapon, and Targeting China, Case Study, Myanmar. This is your area of most intense, I would posit, interest. And when you're talking about this, the current idea that America is withdrawing its imperial ambitions in Asia to concentrate in the Americas in this neo or continue a continuity of agenda manner with the Monroe Doctrine, be it under the Trump corollary, which is mentioned in this document we're talking about. I've watched a video, KJ, where you were giving a presentation not very long ago, saying that, no, this isn't true, that China is the target. And you were saying that you believe an open war against China is imminent, right on the horizon. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. So, it gives me no pleasure to say these words. And I firmly and fervently wish somebody would prove me wrong. But I've been tracking this for a very, very long time. We can look at the development of doctrine. This started in 2009 with an organization called the Office of Net Assessment, which actually just recently has leaked a document for the first time regarding China's overmatch vis-a-vis the United States. But the Office of Net Assessment, run by Andrew Marshall, who was kind of the brain of the Pentagon for over 12 presidents, commissioned a plan of war called Air-Sea Battle. Air-Sea Battle is based on another plan of war or war doctrine that ONA produced called Air-Land Battle, which is the plan of war against the Soviet Union. And Air-Land Battle was actually based on Israeli war doctrine in the Yom Kippur War. Now, to understand Israeli doctrine, you have to understand that essentially Israel's response, because Israel has no strategic depth, it cannot exchange territory for time. It has no way to, retreat and then regroup and attack. And so Israeli war doctrine is incredibly aggressive. It's essentially decapitation of your enemy right from the get-go. This is what we saw very rapidly in the Yom Kippur War. This was adapted for war against the Soviet Union called Air-Land Battle. And then starting 2009, right after the fall of the global financial system, the U.S. understood or realized China was not going to fall or collapse by itself, because prior to that, there was a kind of collapsist doctrine or the idea that we will just kind of assume and absorb China into the global plantation. It will just be a tenant farmer on the global plantation, or it will collapse of its own contradictions. What happened in 2007, 2008 was the entire global financial system collapsed. And that's when the geniuses at the ONA and RAND and elsewhere said, okay, we need to give China a good shove down the stairs because it's not going to fall of its own accord. And so they drafted this plan of war called Air-Sea Battle. It has undergone 9 revisions since. We've only seen the public-facing document, but I assure you, the public-facing document is essentially Israeli war doctrine, immediate land. And if you look at more current documents, they look like they would involve tactical nuclear strikes. So this is frightening stuff. I don't think anybody should... I certainly don't enjoy reading it or, expounding on it, but it is definitely out there. And along with Air-Sea Battle, the U.S. also created a plan of economic warfare called the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which acted of an aircraft carrier against China. And then it also did this kind of political declaration, all kinds of hybrid warfare and pressure, along with surrounding China with a ring of bases, sewing them like dragon's teeth all around the first island chain, which, again, we see in the NSS, and essentially preparing to take down China. I can go a lot more into detail, but, you know, I think...
Well, what about China's nuclear deterrence? They've got submarines, they're a nuclear power. Is that not enough to deter, do you think, this belligerence, this planning to begin what could lead to the blast war?
Well, you know, the first thing is, if you read the documents that are coming out, for example, from the Atlantic Council or from Foreign Affairs, in fact, Andrew Krepinevich, who was actually the author of Air Sea Battle in 2009, wrote an article in Foreign Affairs saying, we need to have a plan of war for China. And that is, you know, a head-scratching statement, because he wrote the plan of war in 2009 and revised it 9 times since. So for him to come out and say that is very head-scratching. But there's a very interesting giveaway line in that document where he says, and we should use tactical nukes to thin out Chinese troops. Let me say that again. Use tactical nukes to thin out Chinese troops, because they know that the Chinese have overmatched, they have more troops, and they're technologically, you know, at least at parity with the United States. So he's casually tossing that out. We don't have a plan. Yes, you do. You wrote it. You wrote it 16 years ago, and it's been revised 9 times since. But he says, oh, and we should, you know, use nukes to thin them out. And so the kind of casualness with which this language is being used, RAND Corporation is now having its interns do internships on wargaming nuclear attacks. And of course, the Atlantic Council says, you know, in order to prevail in war with China, we need to make the use of nuclear weapons seamless with conventional warfare. Secretary Colby has been arguing for the use of nuclear weapons since 2015, specifically in case of war with China, specifically in case of a war over Taiwan. And so all of this speaks to the fact that the U.S. seems very, very much wed to using nuclear war, to using tactical nukes. They consider tactical nukes just to be part of, you know, regular warfare, something that's usable. And I also want to consider at this point are bombs that have a variable yield between tons. The 360 kilotons is about 24 times the power of the Hiroshima atomic bombs. That's what they consider to be tactical. That's what they consider to be usable. And so all of this speaks to, first, you know, the tremendous agenda of war that I've been tracking, you know, for a very, very long time in very, very granular detail. And the second thing is it speaks to, I think, incredible irrationality. I mean, in nuclear war, there are no survivors, or those who survive will envy the dead. But for, you know, the ruling elite, we know they're doing several things. I mean, we know the wealthy ruling elite, they're building bunkers, and there's probably a subsection of them that actually wants the rapture, because they believe that, you know, they will go up to heaven and they want the end of the world. That is a fundamental conflict of interest. I think that if you believe in the rapture, you should not be anywhere near power, certainly not anywhere near, you know, a nuclear device. And so that is, you know, a kind of existential conflict of interest, if you ask me. And then I think, you know, and I say this partly in jest, but partly, true. I think that, you know, inside, you know, the ruling elite, they're already dead, and so they don't fear death. And every time I see Peter Thiel on the, on the screen, I think that looks like death warmed over. That is, you know, the corpse of Roy Cohn reanimated, and therefore they're not afraid of dying. And
maybe not death, maybe post-life. How about that?
Post-life, yeah.
Well, I mean, we
Yes,
could.
absolutely. But your question was, what is China's response? Right. Sorry, I got.
Well, my question is, what about deterrence? I
China,
mean,
this is.
that's the nut of it. I mean, if and when you talk about the lightning war or whatever derivative the Israelis have put on that first strike capability and everything else, well, a long war doesn't seem possible when the supply chain, even America's military supply chain, relies so heavily on China. It would have to get China to continue delivering the electronics and so forth that it needs to continue fighting any kind of war, let alone its explosive components.
You're absolutely correct. And they have pointed out that a war over China, US munitions would be depleted in 2 weeks, if not sooner. And as you point out, exactly, US is reliant on China for its military supply chain, not the least of which are the raw materials for its rare earth elements. China has monopoly, 90% monopoly on rare earth elements. It's been preparing this for 50 years. It's a 5-decade process. And those rare earth elements exist in every high-tech component, every radar, navigation system, night vision system, high-tech electronic system, anything that is sophisticated and advanced, it has Chinese rare earth elements in it. And the Chinese have put 3 sets of sanctions on rare earth elements. They've essentially cut off the supply to military corporations, and they recently, cut off the supply or restricted, put more controls, but made it very difficult. In general, those third sanctions ostensibly have been released, but they could be put back up anytime they want to. So the US is in a difficult position. It's in a difficult position. It cannot easily navigate this, which is why, as you point out, a long war is untenable, and which is why even more, cause to believe that not simply the conventional overmatch, but the incapacity to wage protracted war would lead to the attempt for a rapid nuclear first strike.
Well, KG, we're in a tough position too right now because we're right out of time, and I could talk to you all day, I think, because I feel that we haven't even scratched the surface of what the moment that we face here collectively. Go to Counterpunch to read KJ's article, How to Read the New National Security Strategy Document. It's important, and it's easy for your eyes to glaze. Honestly, I got about two-thirds of the way into it, KJ, and before my eyes started bleeding. But also, KJ is a contributor to Killing Democracy, Western Imperialism's Legacy of Regime Change and Media Manipulation. That with our first guest, Finian Cunningham, and all of the authors now, with your contribution to this segment, I've interviewed in the past, some of them many, many times over the years. Good luck with the book, KJ. Killy or Finian says you can find it at Amazon. That speaking of the near dead or post living entities. But thanks a lot, KJ, for coming on. And I do hope we can speak again at more length.
Absolutely. Great pleasure talking to you.
And thanks to Finian, of course. That's all I've got for this time. Until the next time.
When Rajab was 5 years old, and in 2024, she became one more victim in Israel's Gaza war. Sunglasses and Israeli soldier from the USA. From inside his Merkava tank, he gave the orders that day. And Rajab drove through the rubble with 6 members of her family, with her uncle, aunt, and 3 cousins. Gaza City. Sean Glass and his soldiers fired at the family inside. 300 rounds, that's how the first 6 died. Killed by the Empire of Empire. was shot and killed along with the two men who came to try to save her from the soldiers, each one with a name. Sean Glass gave the orders, there were 23 others involved. After so much research, a mystery was solved. Who was killed by the Empire of Vampires?